Legend has it that a shepherd was led to coffee Arabica by the frolicking of his highly excited goats. That long ago discovery leads us to ask, how did coffee shape our world?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1195th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in up there in Montreal who are tuned in as we stream along in the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, I may as well admit it, I am addicted to coffee. I suppose it began way back when I was a reluctant college student, hanging out in the student union while waiting for the military to carry me off to Vietnam. It did, but not until I picked up a craving for coffee. And there was no better place to have that craving than aboard a U.S. Navy ship on Yankee Station. Some aboard the ship, mostly those we boots called lifers, actually had a permanent crook on their finger from holding a coffee cup 24/7, 365 for about 20 years in a row. But it was while studying Mandarin at UC Berkeley that my addiction to coffee really locked in. I had to learn how to read, write, and speak hundreds of new Chinese characters every week and to work them into sentences and stories, and I had to do so in a class filled with Cantonese-speaking Chinese. I really needed help, and I found it in the triple espressos available at Alfred Pete's Berkeley Coffee Shop. I still start the day with a cup of coffee and get downright grumpy if I can't get one, and I suspect many of you have the same habit. But in fact, the real interesting story about coffee is not the one about you and I. It's the story of how the brewist has transformed the whole of civilization with its caffeinated wakefulness. Today we are going to Vermont to meet the man who tells this incredible story. So pour yourself a cup of Joe and meet Mart Pendergrast, who is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed the World. Wow. Mark, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you aboard.
I hope you've had your coffee this morning.
I have. Yes, I have.
Good.
So are you addicted to coffee, too?
Oh, absolutely. I have to have my coffee in the morning when I get up like everybody else.
Like everybody else. Well, let me ask.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you. You originally published the coffee book in 1999, and republished it again this year. In the decade intervening, have you seen any differences in the world of coffee?
Yes. Oh yes. People have become much more aware that coffee is kind of like wine. That it depends on where it's grown, but also how it is processed. They're also much more aware that the way it's brewed, even the way that it is roasted, can how fresh it is makes all the difference in the world. And you mentioned Alfred Pete. He really began this process back in the 60s in the United States and began the specialty coffee revolution, as we call it.
Right.
The other things that have changed in the last 20 years, climate change has had an impact on coffee as it's had on many other places. So people are having to grow coffee higher up on the mountainside. It's also changed the timing of many of the harvests. And it's going to impact the amount of really good coffee that we can get, because Arabica, as you mentioned, grows best high on mountainsides.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have to climb further up the mountainsides to grow. So that's one of the main changes that we've seen in the past 20 years.
Might have to start growing it up there in Alaska then.
Well, they're beginning to grow it in California, as a matter
of
fact.
I have a good friend who's growing it in San Diego County,
mm-hmm.
and mixed in with avocados, believe it or not. So
that's where they're growing it.
There you go. Well, do you recall the epiphany moment, you know, when that coffee bean fell on your head and you decided you had to write about a subject that's so big, you probably never finished writing about it?
Well, I probably never will. But actually, what happened was I had written a history of Coca-Cola, which has a much shorter history, beginning in 1886. And I was looking for another book that was in some ways similar to that, that was about a product that made a huge difference to people, even though it's really not totally necessary. We could, you know, after we got over our huge addiction to coffee, which would take about a week of maybe excruciating headaches, we would all live without it. But do we want to? No. So the more I looked into the history of coffee, the more fascinating it was, because it impacted the way that we live our lives. It actually sobered up people in Europe substantially so that they could do business. And I think that the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution had a lot to do with the fact that we were drinking coffee rather than drinking huge amounts of alcohol.
We're not talking about little changes in personal lives here. We're talking about major changes in civilization by virtue of this brew.
That's right. In the early London coffee houses, and the British were into coffee before they were really into tea. Lloyd's of London began in Lloyd's Coffee House, so a lot of business was done there. Early newspapers began in coffee houses. And then Bach and Beethoven were drinking huge amounts of coffee while they were composing. So it really has had an impact on creativity and on many people's lives. At the same time, it's always been extremely controversial. Coffee was considered to be bad for you by many, many people throughout the years.
Anything that's this much fun has to be bad, right?
Exactly. So the women of London thought that it caused their men to be impotent. And the men responded that far from that, it made their made them more potent.
There you go.
At the time you were going to Vietnam, there were GI coffee houses outside of many of the barracks where people were being trained to object to the war in Vietnam. And they tried to shut them down. So.
And that's a wonderful story in itself. We hope to pick up just a little bit down the line. But I'd like you, since you did such a great job of it in your book, start us with the creation myth of coffee, with the founding story, as it were.
Well, as you said, the story is that there was a goat herd named Caldy who saw his goats jumping for joy and butting their heads together and playing around. And he noticed that they were eating the red berries of an understory shrub or tree in the rainforest, and that they were also chewing on the leaves.
Mm-hmm. So this is in Ethiopia, right?
That's right, in Ethiopia, up on the mountainsides. So he tried it himself, and he began to feel frisky and happy himself and dancing around and spouting poetry. And supposedly that's how coffee was discovered. It's possible, but it's more likely that somebody early on realized that eating these berries or making a tea out of the leaves, a stimulation for them, and the imams began to have coffee to keep them awake at night. But it wasn't, and that probably was happening as much as early as 800 A.D.,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until the late 1400s that somebody figured out that you could roast the seeds of this plant grind them up, put them in hot water, and produce this rather bitter but intriguing beverage. And so the Ethiopians developed a very elaborate coffee ceremony, similar to the Japanese inventing the elaborate tea mm-hmm. ceremony. And so coffee then began to spread from Ethiopia across the Red Sea to Yemen, where the major port was Mocha. And eventually, the Arabs tried to have a monopoly on coffee. They boiled the cherries to make sure that they couldn't be grown anywhere else. Eventually, an Indian named Baba Budan taped some of the seeds underneath his belt and smuggled them to India. The Dutch got hold of some ripe plants and grew them in their greenhouses and began to grow them in the East Indies, in Java and Ceylon. And eventually the French got hold of one of those plants, took it to Martinique, and from that one tree, most of the plants in Latin America descended. So this is all a very romantic and nice story, except for the fact that in most of these places, they either enslaved the local populations yeah. or they brought in African slaves, as in Haiti,
yeah,
to grow the coffee.
Before we go to the cultivation, I'd like to address, if you will, how coffee really changed our personalities in terms of our civilized beings.
As I said, it for one thing, it made us not so drunk all the time.
and why were we? But why were we drunk all the time? And we were drunk all the time back then.
Yeah. Back in the early 1600s, partly because water was dangerous to drink.
Right.
And beer wasn't. Beer also provided a lot of nutrients. Mm-hmm. People who,
it's like food, liquid bread.
That's right. So a lot of people would have beer soup for breakfast, things like that. And coffee also made people more thoughtful and creative. It yeah. gave them a place to meet that Howard Schultz and others have called the third place.
Would you describe what that means?
Well, it's not work. It's not home. It's a place where people can meet without getting soused and can conduct business or have a date or
right.
write so, a paper.
So here we are in the 1600s. Traditionally, we drink ourselves into oblivion every day or eat it in porridge, but we're boozers. We drink. We're drinking alcohol because it's the only thing we can drink that's safe. And then along comes this coffee stuff. And instead of making us lean against the wall, we're standing up and talking and excited and we're exuberant. And we build coffee houses where we can get together. And holy smokes, a big change in how we go about doing things.
And it also makes us more irreverent and more critical. So many revolutions were planned in coffee houses or taverns that provided coffee. That was true of the American Revolution. It was true of the French Revolution.
And we're going to take a quick break, Gary, right back. This is the Food Chain Radio program.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, we are back. We have a cup of coffee in our hand. We're ready to go on the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about an uncommon grounds with Mark Pendergrass. We're talking about coffee, the way it changed the world. Before the break, we were talking about way back in the 1600s, how we used to live with alcohol in forms of beer, maybe wine. It was what was safe to drink. And so that was a large part of our food. And then we brought in coffee from the Middle East, from Ethiopia, Yemen, And we brewed ourselves up some of this exotic drink, and we started drinking it. And then we started hanging around coffee houses. And instead of falling over drunk, we were standing up excited, and we were talking about issues and ideas, and we were conducting business. It must have been a big change in the body politic, Mark.
Well, as I said, we began to think more clearly. So the coffee houses were actually shut down in Mecca in 1511 because the governor thought that it was causing people to make fun of him. Similarly...
And of course they were, right? They're hanging around drinking coffee and talking about ideas, and they look at the big fat imam and start making jokes, and all of a sudden we had a little bit of revolutionary spirit going.
That's right. And in 1683, King Charles II decided that they were doing the same thing to him. They were making fun of him, and he announced that he was going to close the coffee houses. But he wasn't able to get away with it because it clearly he was going to be overthrown if they did that. So he took it back. So coffee, as I said, has been a source of controversy for many years.
And then of course there was the the Christian and Muslim conflict in which. I guess it was settled by Pope Clement, who finally decided that coffee was indeed a Christian drink as well.
That's right. He said, "If this Satan's drink is so delicious and so useful, that I hereby declare it a fine drink for everyone to have." Can I talk a little bit more about the effect of coffee on the environment?
Oh yeah, we're gonna pick up that when we start talking about cultivation. You're gonna have a whole chunk of time to talk about that. Well, we may as well start. First of all, coffee is fungible, right? In that it is a great trade item, one of the world's great trade items. Correct? Number four on your list?
Yes. It became a huge trade item in the late 1800s. With the invention of steam engines and railroads and international trade being easier. Also, they invented the first really good industrial roaster during the Civil War, so that you had companies beginning to purvey coffee in the United States, such as Chase and Sanborn or Folgers or Hills Brothers or Maxwell House. Unfortunately, most of that coffee was stale by the time it got to people's homes, because the nature of coffee is that when you roast it, it begins to degas immediately. It produces carbon dioxide. So if you put it in an airtight container right when it's roasted, it would explode it. So you have to let it degas before you put it into most cans. The trouble being that means that oxygen can get to it in the meantime, and that stales it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably
microorganisms as well, too, correct?
Some can get in as well, that's right. We've gotten around that in modern times with the one-way valve bag to a large degree, so that they can roast coffee, put it into a bag which lets the air out but won't let any air in, and that keeps it relatively fresh for a much longer time. Although you're still much better off either roasting your own at home, and there are a number of ways you can do that, including a popcorn popper, you can buy relatively expensive roasters and do it at home, or you can get fresh roasted coffee from a local brew house and grind it yourself right away and pour over, or have a French roast, are the two of my favorite ways to have coffee.
So then once the coffee is harvested, it's down the road to decomposition. So how do you capture it and have that fresh cup of coffee? So the closer you get to the roaster, the better off you're going to be.
I think that's true. Also, there are a number of ways to process coffee. You can either, you have to get the seed out of it, and that's not as simple as it would sound because there's a pulp that sticks to it. So either you can dry it inside the cherry, which is called the natural way, and the problem with that is it's very easy for that to have mold or have other problems with it. So you have to be extremely careful if you use the natural method. Or you can strip off the outside of it and put it in water for 24 to 48 hours. It's called the wet method. And gradually it will ferment and the outside will... You can get it to fall off. You don't want to over-ferment it. And that adds a certain quality to the cup. And nowadays, there are all kinds of in-between methods, such as the honey method of stripping it off and then letting it dry, but not allowing it to ferment. And they all add a certain quality to the cup. And that's one of the things that has begun to happen is that a lot of the smaller specialty roasters have formed relationships with particular farms and are going down and helping them to pick out the best beans from a particular mountainside and helping them to process it in a particular way so that it really is getting the best out of the beans.
Well, good. That's a good segue for cultivation. And as we talked about earlier, coffee is very fungible. It's a great commodity. People can make a lot of money on it because it can only be grown in the tropics and then shipped up to where most of us live, I guess. And so there you have a commodity. Where does coffee grow best?
It grows best on volcanic mountainsides between about 3,000 and 6,000 feet high, between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, in this sort of belt around the equator. And it had spread to all of the countries within that range by the late 1800s, early 1900s. As I said, that's beginning to change with climate change now, but that's where it grows primarily.
And some of the big countries where coffee produces, I think Brazil probably being the biggest, correct?
That's right. Brazil is the largest producer of coffee. And what happened, by the way, in the late 19th century was that Brazil began to grow so much coffee that the bottom dropped out of the market and you had a bust and they began to even burn their coffee, especially during the Depression, but before that as well.
Use it for fuel?
No, just burn it.
Just burned it, huh?
To get rid of it. Great big heaping mounds of it.
Wow.
And that began the boom-bust cycle, which we see to this day, where there will be too much coffee. People will not know what to do because the price goes below the cost of production, so they stop fertilizing it, they stop pruning it, and sometimes they'll even cut down the trees. They'll abandon whole farms. And then along comes higher prices as it declines, and people begin to grow more coffee again. It takes about 4 years from the time you plant a coffee tree until it begins to produce harvestable beans. So you have this delayed reaction, and then again you'll have too much coffee, or there'll be a drought in Brazil or a hard freeze in Brazil, and suddenly the price will spike up again. Every time the price has spiked up really high, In many cases in the United States, there have been squawking and screaming and yelling and saying, oh, this is terrible. There must be a communist plot down in Latin America or in Africa that is causing the price to rise high. And usually that was not the case. You know, for a long, long time, and still, people who do the hardest work on coffee make the least amount of money.
Before we go there, would you tell us about the valorizing of prices that was attempted? And I guess it's still being attempted today in other commodity crops as well.
Yeah, the valorization process was in the early 1900s as the Brazilians began to grow too much coffee. They began to hold it artificially off of the market. This was before they got so desperate they began to burn it. And a man named Hermann Seelken, a German coffee dealer, helped to facilitate this in the United States and grew very rich on it. So I have a whole chapter on Hermann Seelken in my book.
And essentially what he was doing was trying to even out the prices by buying excess.
And we tried to do that. We tried to help do that from 1962 to 1989 in the United States because we were afraid that if the price of coffee went too low, that the communists would indeed make inroads as people became desperate in Latin America and in Africa. So even though it went against our free trade ethos, we were willing to have some sort of control scheme. In 1989, with the demise of the Cold War, we backed out of that agreement, and the price of coffee immediately dropped horribly, and it's been worse since then. Nobody liked this international coffee agreement very well because people cheated and smuggled coffee between countries, etc., but it was at least an attempt to even out the prices.
And you really see that throughout the world of commodities, whether it's cotton or wheat or soybeans or even oil.
That's right. Where people are continually attempting to control how much is out there and artificially manipulate the price.
So let's turn now to the production, and it's a plain and simple fact that to get for us to get the coffee, somebody has to pick the right beans, correct?
That's right.
And it's labor-intensive stuff.
Very labor-intensive because the coffee cherries don't ripen at the same time, even on one tree. So you have to go back and hand-pick the coffee repeatedly during the harvest season. And if it's not, if you pick too many green beans, it affects the taste of the coffee. There are artificial harvesters in places where it's not so hilly, as in many places in Brazil, but they don't do a really great job of harvesting the coffee.
Yeah, so
it's very labor intensive in terms of processing it, drying it, transporting it, etc. And as I said, most of the money is made from the time it's roasted, which is usually far away in a consuming country. Although more and more now, places such as Ethiopia or Brazil or even places like Costa Rica are beginning to drink more and more of their own good coffee rather than only keeping the lousy stuff and exporting all the good stuff.
And then, of course, what that means is that you have to find laborers. And throughout the history of coffee, I guess that meant slaves, right?
Yes, it did. So that the Dutch enslaved the natives of the East Indies, many of whom died of starvation because they were not treated very well. Similarly, African slaves were brought into the Caribbean, and in 1791, the island which we now know as Haiti and the Dominican Republic, there was a slave rebellion, the only successful slave rebellion in history that I'm aware of. And the first thing they did was to destroy the coffee and the sugar plantations, which is understandable, but it also has resulted in that country being really poor and troubled ever since then.
Forever poor. When we come back, I'd like to address the problem of cultivation and desertification and the damage wrought on the environment by the cultivation of coffee. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? With Mark Pendergrast, who is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. A great big story on a great big subject that goes on and on and on and on and will probably never end. Why will it never end? Because we're not ready to give up our coffee habit. Ain't gonna happen. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we do have a lot to talk about because we haven't even got to the coffee house yet, which is the third place. But I want to pick up the environmental degradation that's been caused throughout the developing world by the production of coffee. Big part of your book, Mark.
Well, coffee has been grown under the traditional shade trees for much of its history, but in Brazil, that's not true. So they would clear cut the rainforest and burn it, and it would produce fertile ash where they would be able to grow the coffee for a period of time, and then it would exhaust the land, and they would go on and burn another section, and it caused enormous degradation that way. Similarly, though, in places where they were using the wet process, such as Guatemala or Kenya, they were washing the cherry pulp downstream, where it would decompose, kill the fish, and pollute the water. The good news nowadays is that they discovered that coffee grown under a rainforest canopy is not only tastier, but because it grows more slowly and develops more taste that way, but that it's actually good for migratory birds. It turns out that as they were cutting down rainforests to grow technified coffee, the kind of coffee that did not need an overstory, the migratory bird population was in decline, and many ornithologists realized that the closest thing we have to a real rainforest is a coffee plantation with shade trees. So now there's a big movement to try to grow coffee under shade that is bird-friendly rather than in full sun.
So when we hear that coffee is shade-grown, there's a real sense to that. There's reason there. It's not just some politically correct notion. The coffee is better, and better for us and better for the environment.
I think that's true, although some people argue about whether it's better for you or not, but it certainly is better for the environment.
Okay.
And for the birds and for other biodiversity as well, and it's a lot more pleasant to walk through.
Amen. Well, and of course, that's the problem with a lot of monocropped kinds of agriculture, where you go to the Midwest and you see 10,000 acres of soybeans, and it's kind of depressing when it gets right down to it, because there's not much life there.
It's also dangerous because, you know, coffee is a natural pesticide. That's why it has the caffeine in it. Is to try to ward off diseases and pests. But when you grow a monoculture, as they did in much of the East Indies, nature will find a way around it. And so fungus called coffee leaf rust, or Himalaya vastatrix is the official Latin name, it decimated the coffee plantations in the late 1800s, And more recently, when it finally jumped to Latin America, there was a horrible leaf rust epidemic, which is ongoing in Latin America. And so they've had to develop strains of coffee which can withstand this fungus.
Then take us now to the United States of America and our coffee habit, made largely possible by some people who were very astute business people and who knew how to advertise and sell us on drinking coffee.
Well, early on, you know, people like Joel Cheek, who ran Maxwell House Coffee, came up with, you know, that it was good to the last drop.
Good to the last drop, right. And we still remember that, don't we?
We do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the little percolator song, ba-da-da-da-dum-bum, ba-da-da-dum-bum, ba-da-da-da-dum-bum. Unfortunately, it was celebrating a rather terrible way to make coffee, which is a percolator. and many of the early advertisements were also quite sexist. So I have pictures in the book of a husband throwing hot coffee on his wife because he doesn't like it and says, "It's terrible. See how you like it." And that was a Chase and Sanborn ad from the 1930s. There's another picture from the 1960s of a wife with a coffee cup dumped on top of her head. And, you know, "I can show you how to make better coffee."
You know, what's interesting about that? The interesting thing about that, Mark, is that it seems like the guys are always the stupid ones now in today's TV commercials. It's always the guy that's a real bozo and you want to throw coffee on. It's kind of funny how that all shook out. But we turn to coffee houses, and you know, in reading your book, I was really amazed that it took a Joseph Schultz to see the potential, Howard Schultz, that to see the potential of coffee houses here in the United States. We're aware, of course, of Alfred Peet's initial efforts, but it was really Howard Schultz that turned the world upside down with coffee houses. How did that all start?
Well, he read a book called The Great Good Place by Ray Oldenburg, a sociologist, who was arguing that coffee houses could be one of these third places, as he called it. And Schultz latched onto that. And he wasn't the only one, of course, that was starting coffee houses in the U.S., but he popularized that term and the idea of the, quote, Starbucks experience as a place that people could go where they could enjoy themselves and meet, even if they were meeting just to be alone sometimes.
Yeah, how was it, a quote from your book, Uncommon Grounds, when something like, "Coffee houses are for people who want to be alone but need a lot of people to do it."
Yeah, who want to be alone together.
Yeah, who want to be alone together.
And that's true. We are sociable people, and more through the internet, we're less social because we, you know, don't see each other all that frequently. And coffee houses are even more important in places like that, where people can go to get together. And as I said, they can either go on a date or to do business or to just enjoy their coffee.
Right, and Howard started out as a salesperson for Starbucks, correct?
Yes, he was selling plastic devices, actually. And he noticed that this little company called Starbucks was ordering more and more press pots and other espresso machines, and he thought, So he went and began to work for them, and then he was sent to a conference in Italy.
Yeah.
And he saw this wonderful theater of the baristas making espresso and thought, you know...
Well, wait a minute. What do you mean by theater?
Well, they would very elegantly pull a shot of espresso and serve it up with great panache. And he thought, this is what we need in the United States. You know, Starbucks at that time didn't have coffee houses. They were simply serving fresh roasted coffee and telling people to make it at home. They weren't serving them.
Yeah. It wasn't a theater.
Schultz began to make espresso-based drinks. He added a lot more milk than the Italians do, but it really revolutionized the way that we drink coffee in coffee houses now, these espresso-based lattes and cappuccinos.
So it's like a mixed drink at a bar. Instead of ordering just whiskey, you're ordering a Manhattan or something like that.
In many ways, that's true, yes. And, you know, a lot of people made fun of Starbucks for that. And all the lingo that they made up for it.
So Schultz bought Starbucks for $3 million, right?
Yes, he bought out the original three partners, some of whom then bought Pete's. Began to turn it into a similar sort of chain.
Thus you have the West Coast axis of Seattle with Starbucks and San Francisco with Pete's, and they spread across. How did those two chains explode across the country in the way in which they did? What was the magic there?
Well, it was mostly Schultz deciding that he could spread Starbucks first to Chicago and then to places like Los Angeles, where it doesn't have the long winters, and you wouldn't think that it would have done so well, but it has. And he began to spread them all over first the United States and then the world, spreading to places first like Japan, where they did incredibly well. And finally, he's gotten back to start one in Italy. Although it hasn't done nearly as well in Italy as it has the rest of the world, ironically.
Would that be because Italy has a long tradition of coffee houses like Starbucks?
They're not like Starbucks. The coffee houses in Italy, you usually go in, drink a shot very quickly while standing up, and then go back to work. And you might do this several times a day. So Starbucks actually does offer something new, the ability to sit down rather than just at a cafe. But Italy also has a long tradition of cafes, and I think that they, you know, resist the Americans,
sure.
We're
certainly not going to do anything the Americans are going to do. And how is Starbucks doing now? Do you see it growing in the way it grew, or has the growth slowed down, or where are we today with Starbucks?
I think they've slowed down. Schultz has retired and was considering being one of the 8 million people running for president, but he apparently has decided against that. They're certainly continuing to do well. They've had controversies, such as the Starbucks in which the manager called the police to arrest two black men who weren't ordering coffee.
Right.
And it turns out they were just waiting for a meeting with somebody. They were waiting for somebody to show up, and that caused a huge, huge flap and, you know, anti-racist training.
Sure, it was kind of like almost the Me Too movement, too. You step into something that's so hyper-political, you're going to get in trouble. You know, one of the things that really confused me is that as Howard Schultz was exploding Starbucks, what happened to the mainline coffee people like Folgers and whatnot? Why were they sleeping? Didn't they see the incredible potential here as Howard Schultz saw it?
At first, they did not see that, no. They continued to go about their business of producing mediocre coffee in cans, convinced that this was just a gnat on their backside. As it became clear that the specialty revolution, and it wasn't just Starbucks, there were many, many other smaller roasters and then many who have grown quite large, they began to buy up specialty roasters. And you've had the consolidation of the industry that has been going on. And that happens in many food industries where somebody will begin something that's at first small and revolutionary, and then somebody will buy them up. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Coca-Cola, which I mentioned earlier, has bought the Costa chain of coffee houses in the United Kingdom. And you see this sort of cycle of consolidation and of homogenization and of, you know, Starbucks being perceived as sort of the McDonald's of the coffee chain. At the same time, you're beginning to have much more consciousness and demand for better coffee. And that has also been true of places like Folgers or Maxwell House, where they no longer are mixing Robusta necessarily with their better quality products. It's at least all Arabica. Robusta is the not so good type of coffee.
Right. So in a way, we're all becoming coffee connoisseurs and demanding.
Yes. I think people are much more aware of the need for better quality beans.
Let's go
and,
back for
there are many people who are coffee snobs who are very aware of, you know, not only the country it comes from, but the particular estate or farm and how it's being processed.
And thus, that's probably where the big change will be in the coming years, you think? We're all going to
be. No, I don't think they'll ever get. I don't think they'll ever get that far.
It won't.
and it's still the majority of what people drink.
Yeah. Well, so Kerry, we're just running out of time here. But what a wonderful story you've told here, and thank you for bringing it to us. I think we learn a lot when we look at the commodities that make up our lives. Mark Pendergrass, Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. Thank you for joining us, Mark. Really appreciate it. Folks, remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.